This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Charlie Zimmerman.
David Lewis is a Grand Ronde Tribal member and assistant professor of anthropology and indigenous studies at Oregon State University. His new book, Tribal Histories of the Willamette Valley, explores the often neglected stories and histories of the dozens of tribes that make up the modern Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde Community of Oregon. David Lewis is our guest on the JX. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
So just to get a sense of the big picture, who are we talking about when we talk about Grand Ronde, considering it is a large confederation?
Yeah, so the Grand Ronde Reservation was formed out of about 32 tribes that came to the reservation in 1856. And that's all the tribes from the Willamette Valley, the central area of the Columbia River, and all the way down through the Umpqua Valley, and even tribes from the Rogue River Valley.
Yeah, so for our listeners, that does include some tribes from here in southern Oregon. I believe the Tequelma are a significant part of the Grand Ronde community. Is that correct?
Yeah, Tequelma, Shasta, the northern Shasta people, even the Cow Creek or the other Tequelma speakers that were around Grants Pass, yeah.
So, and kind of starting from the 19th century, kind of where you start your book. So why was Oregon, specifically the Willamette Valley, so desirable to American settlers?
Well, I mean, it had become like a really good area to sort of get furs, to hunt furs, and so Hudson's Bay Company set up shop here. And then their activities attracted other folks to come explore the wealth of the area, the Americans, because they wanted to at some point, claim a nation all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And so this attracted, their explorations attracted settlers to the area. And so they noticed that the soils in Western Oregon and the valleys are really good. And so and they had really good water, really good, fair sunlight. And so they thought it was a kind of an Eden. They call it the Eden in their writings, and that attracted a lot of people to come and seek a really kind of a free landscape of opportunity for themselves.
And what did the American government do to facilitate this settlement of Oregon?
Well, they made arrangements with Great Britain to sort of co-claim the area. They basically gave license for Americans to come to this area. They didn't give the tribes much help or support in their own sort of claims to their own lands. And then passed laws like the New Donation Land Claim Act to allow Americans to claim land for free if they stayed on for 5 years. And so that all came before treaties.
And so there was the Oregon Donation Land Claim Act, I believe that was that 1850?
Yeah.
And then there was the Homestead Act of 1862. And what was the impact of both of those, specifically the latter, since you already kind of touched on the former?
Yeah, they both attracted tens of thousands of peoples to come to the West Coast, to Oregon, to Washington, to even California, Idaho, Montana, to come and claim land and seek opportunity on the West Coast where they could, gain wealth by taking land away from Native peoples.
And kind of what were the relationships like between these settlers and the indigenous people of Oregon?
Well, for the most part, it was very conflictual. Most times settlers didn't recognize Native people in their rights of having been on land for a very long time, upwards of 10,000 years. And so they didn't know that. They just didn't consider them even sometimes people, and they began pushing them further and further into from the margins of where they called their land. And this caused, obviously conflicts. When you're being pushed off your land, you're not very happy, and so the tribes pushed back. And so there was this push back and forth conflict over rights, and some of it was caused by settlers, some of it was caused by tribes, but the by and large, what I ascribe as the biggest problem was settlers ignoring humanity and the rights of Native peoples and simply taking whatever they wanted to take from the tribes without asking permission or even sometimes giving them the respect of having a conversation with them. So, yeah.
Of course. And, you know, a really significant figure in this, I think, was Joel Palmer. So who was he?
So he came, he was an early settler, came to Oregon, and in 1844, 45, and he, you know, he was a trailblazer, kind of a mountain man. He also worked for the government. He, you know, served in the volunteer militia as a supply or provision general. And then later on, he became kind of a political figure, and then he was appointed as Indian Affairs, the Indian Superintendent of Oregon in 1853. And he's had already been here for a while, and so he set up, he already knew kind of how to speak with Native peoples and somewhat respected them as people. So he began setting up treaties with them and having them, you know, give cede their land to the United States in the treaties, and then set up reservations for them too. So he set up the majority of the treaties for Oregon, as well as the majority of the reservations for Oregon are all set up by him.
So tell me about the treaties. What did they look like exactly?
The treaties were fairly long, you know, several pages, and they had various provisions in them. And a lot of, and what it was is basically the tribes felt they had to sign these treaties and sell their land in exchange for maybe a permanent reservation of their own, permanent piece of land of their own, where they would not be bothered by Americans, because Americans were, you know, conflicted with them. And so, and then they would be paid some money and services and get education and medical care and things like that. And so there was an exchange for the tribes, and they literally passed upwards of 19, 20 million acres in Western Oregon to the United States in seven treaties that were ratified.
And, of course, it's true that many of these treaties were ultimately broken by the U.S. government. So can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I think that's the truth. I don't think anybody's, like, proven that exactly in a court of law. I think what we're talking about is, you know, if the treaty made a promise that we'd pay you a certain amount of money, or we would educate you, or we would give you land for farming or whatever it is, the tribes didn't really get that. It took a long time, took 20 years and get Grand Ronde, people get any kind of like significant parcel of land. And they were not really well supported by the Americans, even though they were supposed to have money and support in terms of like, you know, like healthcare and education and other services. And so that took a long time to actually happen. And the tribes, you know, learned to live kind of on their own, because they were on their own without federal help. And so those are called the broken treaties, because they basically gave all this land for very sort of low prices to the United States, millions and millions of acres of land, and the United States didn't really live up to what they said they were going to do.
David Lewis is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, author of Tribal Histories of the Willamette Valley. So was the Grand Ronde Confederation in existence at this time, or were all of these like 30-something tribes still independent?
At the reservation, there were kind of tribal groupings. You know, it has always been the case that Native people were intermarried with other tribes, so that was not necessarily a problem. It's just they were forced to remain on the reservation once they got there. They were not U.S. citizens, so they were not allowed to leave. And so it was kind of, some people have described it as a prison camp, imprisoning Native people on a reservation without really any rights, even though the whole land was originally their own land. So the Grand Ronde Reservation existed. It wasn't until the 1870s they formed an Indian legislature. So they began sort of organizing together to give them some rights. And it wasn't until the 1924 they got citizenship of the United States and were able to legally sort of leave the reservation. And so it was a long term coming, and terminations happened in the 1950s. So over 100 years, you know, they developed more of our rights, but that took generations of, and a lot of people died in the process. And so they didn't really get I would say they didn't really get what they were promised they would get.
So walk me back a little bit. How did all of these different tribes end up on one reservation altogether?
Well, the initial plan was to place all the tribes in Oregon on one reservation. And they wanted to move, the federal government wanted to move them all over to, like, Umatilla. And the people at Umatilla were not really helpful with that. They were not approving of that. Then the people of Western Oregon, when they proposed that, they said, we don't want to move to this strange area. So they were forced to, the federal government was forced to allow them to sort of stay in Western Oregon, and they had to devise a new plan. The new plan became the Coast Reservation at first, but because there was lots of conflict and war in the north and the south in Oregon, Palmer was forced to sort of quickly make a new plan. And the new plan in, like, you know, November of 1855 was to create a new reservation closer to the Lamont Valley with more services, more access to the valley, called the Grand Ronde Reservation. And so that was kind of somewhat associated with the Coast Reservation at first, but it became a separate reservation in 1857.
So when was the sort of the Coast Reservation, when was that, essentially, when were people forced there, and when was that essentially given to the American settlers?
Well, the Coast Reservation began by executive order in 1855, but there was nobody actually moved onto the reservation except for the people that were already living there, the Native people already there. But nobody was moved there until 1856. And so over the course of the next 100 years, it was decreased significantly. In 1865, it lost a section. In 1875, it lost two sections. In 1907, 1908, it lost another big section and was reduced down to what was called the Sletz Reservation Agency, which is kind of in the mountains on the Sletz River. And so originally it was 1.1 million acres. It was reduced down to just a few thousand acres by the 20th century. And then in termination, they lost everything else. It was terminated and they lost another 2,000 acres there. So Grand Ronde had started out as 60,000 acres, and it wasn't reduced until the Dawes Act, and they lost about 30,000 acres there. And then people sold their lands by 1920, and by 1950, the reservation was reduced down to about 597 acres.
So what exactly is the Dawes Act? What kind of impact did that have on people in the Willamette Valley?
So the Dawes Act was a plan by the federal government to give every Native person on a reservation a piece of land as their own, like a farm. And it was about 250 acres apiece. It would sound like a fair plan. The problem was on the other end of the plan, once everybody got an allotment, the rest of the land on the reservation was slated to be sold as surplus land. About 30-something thousand acres was allotted at Grand Ronde. The other 30,000 acres was sold as surplus land. And then nobody after that initial allotment period was allowed any more allotments. So if you were born after, 1887, which is the date of the act, you couldn't get an allotment on your own. And so all the other generations of people that were born after that either had to go live with their parents on their farms, or somehow inherit their parents' farm, or move off the reservation. It was not really a sustainable plan at all.
And kind of did this lead to a shift in lifestyle, for instance, like a shift towards agriculture?
Yeah, that already began. The initial plan in the treaties was actually to have all the adults become farmers and to shift their whole culture from living as Native people in the environment, not really growing anything. Didn't have agriculture in Oregon, to becoming more farmer-based, like our true American lifestyle at the time. And so people were doing that. By the 1860s, 1870s, most of the people at the reservations were actually farming or ranching in some way and were pretty good at it. And by the 1880s, they were determined to be self-sufficient at Grand Ronde.
We're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back with David Lewis.
Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Charlie Zimmerman, speaking with David Lewis, author of Tribal Histories of the Willamette Valley. So I want to move on sort of to the late 19th, early 20th century, specifically, you know, this is like the boarding school era. So can you talk about that and the significance of that?
Yeah, the government wanted, the federal government wanted to move the population of the reservations more quickly into an American lifestyle, or they call it assimilation. They wanted to assimilate people into American lifestyle. And so they decided that the best way to do this would be to force Native people, Native kids, onto boarding schools off reservations, sometimes like thousands of miles away, and force them to, you know, adapt to English, you know, language, adapt the lifestyles and, you know, the dress and the all the social codes of Americans. And they kept sometimes these children in these schools for 16, 17 years or more. Or at least till, you know, they're like, technically they'd be like a junior in high school, in our high schools today. So, and actually didn't actually give a high school diploma. They had to go to a regular high school to get actually a high school diploma afterwards if they wanted to. But this forced tens of thousands of Native American youth to sort of lose track of their culture, sometimes lose their language. And many people never even returned home. They just stayed where they in the vicinity of where the school was and got jobs in the local towns. And this in this way, we lost, you know, thousands and thousands of Native people to assimilation. So that's how it worked.
So what happened to the people who did get to go home? Like, what kind of impacts were there on the community?
Well, sometimes it was positive. You know, there were needs, like the communities on reservations were a lot of times also assimilating, adjusting to an American lifestyle. Many of them becoming farmers and ranchers or had other kind of industries. And so they needed, you know, blacksmiths and painters and carpenters and things like this that could do things in a sort of American modern way. But the need for that on the reservations is less than in the cities. And so people a lot of times couldn't get jobs on the reservation, so they had to move to the city to get a job. And then they adopted a lifestyle of going back and forth on the weekends between, you know, the city and the reservation to meet up with their family, to have barbecues, to go to holiday events, whatever it is. So we adopted the sort of off-reservation, on-reservation lifestyle for a good long time in the 20th century. So this helped a lot of people assimilate to American lifestyle.
And what were the impacts on languages that were spoken by the Grand Ronde people?
Well, we lost most of our languages were going extinct or extinct by the 1950s. Kalapuya itself, one of the main subjects of my book, the Kalapuya people, really stopped being spoken by 1954. The last speaker may have been alive into the 1960s. The only language that we had left was Chinook Wawa, which was a language sort of commonly spoken among all the people, all the tribes in the houses and stuff. And so that survived, and we have that at Grand Ronde. And in every reservation in Oregon has at least one or more languages that have survived, and they've had a lot of work done to keep them around. But most of the other languages, most of the other 30-something languages at Grand Ronde or dialects of languages are extinct.
And are there any efforts to revitalize these languages, such as with the tapes collected by various ethnographers?
Yeah, Chinook Wawa has had a lot of work done for some 30 years, work 30, maybe 40 years, work has been done at Grand Ronde to bring it, to teach it, to teach the next generation the language, to bring it back, make it more common, you know, language at the reservation. And we see some successes. The languages like Kalapuya has been studied. We've done, you know, a dictionary. We've done some books with it. We've worked on bringing some words back into the dialect. into what we use today. But there hasn't yet been a project at the reservation to bring Kalpuya back. And then there's been nothing done with Umpqua, and, you know, our tribe has done nothing with Tekelma, even though Cow Creek tribe has done Tekelma language. We haven't done anything with Clackamas necessarily. We've brought some Clackamas words into Chinookwala, but we haven't really worked on Clackamas itself or any of the other dialects in the valley, because it's just, it's a hugely expensive thing to try to bring a language back. Because you have to have a body of teachers, of people, somebody really interested in that, a body of teachers, and you have to have people that are learning the language or are studying it, that have basically focused their whole career on that, and that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, but tell me about Chinookwala. So what exactly is that?
Chinookwala is a language. It was a common language between tribes. Initially, it was called Chinook jargon, and it was considered a language of trade. But at Grand Ronde, because we had 32 tribes move there, and most of them spoke the Chinookwala or some version of it, they all began speaking it together. And that's like you could imagine, like the Chinook people from the Columbia and the Tekelmas all on the same reservation. Chinook and Tekelma language are not intelligible at all. But if you both speak Chinookwala, then you can speak together. So that's what happened. They began speaking that together in tribal gatherings, in events, in the homes, between family members and stuff. And that actually took prominence in some locations at the reservation over English. And so that's what we have.
And so later in the 20th century was the termination era. So can you explain what that was?
Yeah, the United States had decided by the 1940s that it didn't want to continue forever paying for reservations. A lot of politicians at the time period thought that the money for reservations could be better used for other projects in the United States, like water reclamation and damming and stuff like that. And so they decided to find a way to eliminate the reservations. And then by doing so, you also eliminate the claims on a bunch of raw natural resources that were not being sort of mined and extracted from the environment, because reservations actually made up a lot of land that was not being exploited like we were, you know, logging in other areas of the forest and stuff. So the plan was to terminate the tribes, to make them sort of equal citizens, to pay them a little bit of money for their land and their time, and then to get access to all these raw resources and turn that into, you know, more economic growth for like Oregon and California and things like that. So, it was a successful project of the federal government for Western Oregon tribes and Klamath. They were terminated. All the Western Oregon tribes and Klamath were all terminated, and those resources did become, you know, raw resources that were exploited by companies in Oregon and even California. And then the tribes in the 1970s and 80s decided to get restored, and so they came back. And so many of the tribes came back, in fact, more than were recognized before, if you include Cow Creek and Coos and Coquille in that number.
David Lewis is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, author of Tribal Histories of the Willamette Valley. So what exactly does restoration mean? So they just basically, it's like it never happened?
No, not necessarily. I think it's a good question about what it actually means, because each tribe has its own sort of meaning. You know, like I said, some tribes came back all anew. They had been part of like Grand Ronde Schluss before, and they all of a sudden they were new tribes. What it appears is that there's kind of a reset where the tribes begin their history in like 1977 or 1980s, depending on what tribe you are, and it puts back onto the responsibility of the federal government, the treaties. All the treaties come back, the rights of the tribes come back, except for a couple things. For Grand Ronde and Sulettes, we were forced to give up hunting and fishing. because of some political lobbies that were against us at the time. But for the most part, all the other rights from the treaties come back to us. And then part of, you know, probably the legacy of termination is, you know, like that was probably the last straw in terms of the collapse of the languages, because people stopped speaking languages together. When the reservations were terminated, people sort of left, went to like cities all over the United States to get jobs and go to school and stuff. And so that caused a kind of a blowing up of the tribal center, where there wasn't anybody speaking their native languages anymore. And so, we lost a lot of language, we lost some culture there. And then we lost people too. A lot of people did not hear or did not get on the final termination roll. And so when we came for restoration and the tribe based its restoration on that termination roll, then there's whole families that may have not made it back onto the new rolls. So there's a whole legacy there that needs to be sort of delved into to figure out what happened, mainly because the federal government didn't really care. I mean, they just wanted the resources. They didn't care about the tribes at all. And they did whatever they wanted to do. And we had to sort of deal with that.
So what about the modern Grand Ronde community? How have they been working to heal from the kind of ongoing effects of colonialism?
We've been working on some 40 years now. I think it's the 40th year this year of restoration. The tribe has developed all these different resources. You know, we have healthcare, we have social services, we have education, we have natural resources. We have a casino, we have a little industry that now that we're working with to sort of fund all that stuff. And then in culture, we've been working for 25 years at least to bring back culture, to bring back language as best we can, to study it. The biggest problem with culture, though, is it doesn't make any money, so they have to spend money on that. So, and that's not something that a kind of a growing economy wants to do. So you have to kind of force that issue, because we're a tribe, we're not just a government, so we have a culture as well. So, but we've been working on culture. We've built, you know, a plank house. We have a museum now. We have all these people at the reservation, and I was one at one point, planning and working on advancing our cultural knowledge and our language knowledge while we're developing our services for the tribal members too.
Yeah, the plank house, I've gotten to go out there. It's really beautiful. You just walk in, you can just smell the wood, and I can understand how just being there is healing. And just to wrap it up, do you have any sort of last takeaways that you'd like people to get out of your book?
Yeah, my book is about all that. I mean, I focus on the Willamette Valley, but then I focus on mainly the stories between the tribes and the settlers and how kind of unfair the whole thing was, and how, you know, how much was taken away from us kind of illegally, and the attitude of the settlers doing so. And so I think that it's eye-opening for a lot of folks to read this and realize that all the history you've been taught about Native peoples in Oregon before has not taught you this. This is something new.
We've been speaking with David Lewis, author of Tribal Histories of the Willamette Valley. David, thanks for being my guest on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Jefferson Exchange. You can find this program and more at our website, jeffexchange.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Charlie Zimmerman, the assistant producer. Zach Beagle is an engineer. Angela Decker is our senior producer. Jeffrey Riley is our standard host, and our theme music is composed by Maxwell and Terry Longshore. Have a great day.